TV
podcast on the television.
We had a week off. When did we last podcast?
I believe our last LKTV was when Rose Abdu from Gilmore Girls joined us.
Oh, so that was a couple weeks ago. A few days before Christmas.
Yeah, we took a week off.
When last we podcasted?
When last we podcasted? Yes.
That's why you forgot to say TV.
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 Sorry about that. So LKTV.
Because we pretended we didn't have this job anymore.
Right.
For a little while.
For a blissful blip. You are Dave Wyatt and I'm Alonzo Duralde.
It's actually fun doing this. I wouldn't say it's blissful to be away.
But it's everybody needs a break.
It does feel like a vacation, though.
Yeah.
A little bit of one.
Yes. We had naps to take and chocolates to consume.
I had a lot of naps. And
I will have more naps before this is all over.
But I never really stopped working in one sense because I've been, well, there's just been so much to do.
No,
you know,
of course.
Christmas is a lot of energy.
Yes.
It's a lot of work and things that you know how I love to make a list.
Yes, I do.
Christmas involves so many different lists of things to do and things to go get and things to accomplish. I'm in the zone of lists.
You're in list vana.
Yeah.
Whereas I've had actual work still going on. Like yesterday, filed my last review of the year for The Wrap, where I'm the film reviews editor.
You know what? Because we're doing this one for free.
I know. That's why I was trying to introduce us before you.
We should introduce ourselves. Normally, yes. Okay, so this is LKTV, and normally this is a podcast that's just for the subscribers via our Patreon subscription system.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife.
But because
it's the holidays.
We're the ghosts of Christmas present, and we like life, and we wear big robes and have wreaths around our heads and have a giant banquet of food available to anyone who comes to our home. This is our Christmas present to you.
Yes, the non-subscribers.
Actually, it's more, this is just one of them, because up until, I'd say, like, the end of next week, which it's like a two-week period of time where you and I have very little to accomplish except for all the things we haven't had time to accomplish before that before that break. So my feeling was, and you said you agreed, any LKTVs we do during this break time, it's going out for free to everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we do one, we do two, we do three. You know, who knows how many we're going
to
do.
And we may also have some extra episodes of Linoleum Knife, a podcast of the cinema, just to tidy up all of the
true, but those are always free.
And right, but yeah. I'm just saying there may be more than one over the course of a week, because you've got a bunch of movies to catch up on.
We have
a bunch of letters to catch up on.
I only did one. I watched one film and reviewed one film last week, and that was Tony Erdmann.
Yeah.
And we'll be talking about that on the episode,
right?
When we do it, but I'm kind of behind. Like,
yeah, I have things to watch.
I just haven't, you know, haven't felt like it. I'm just feeling like I want to relax a little bit. Just have a little cool down.
We had some downtime. It was nice.
So anyway, because this is free, it's going out to everyone who normally just hears Linoleum Knife for free.
Yes.
It's going out to the Linoleum Knife subscribers, correct?
Of course.
Via iTunes, is that what's going to happen?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And And so if you are not a Patreon subscriber, this is what you're missing.
And if you are not, if you're brand new to us, normally we are Linoleum Knife. This right. is LKTV.
Yes.
My name is Dave White. He is Alonzo Duralde.
Right.
We're both film critics,
mm-hmm.
but this is our TV podcast,
yes.
the second one that we do.
Yes.
What else do you need to know about us if you're brand new? We're homosexuals. Also, we're married to each other,
yep.
which makes us the only film critics in the United States who are working as film critics and married to each other as gays.
I think that's true.
Yeah.
I've yet to... No one has stepped forward.
Whoever else is doing it, tell
dispute
us.
Dispute this claim.
Let's guest on each other's podcasts,
there you go.
Shall we? But the... that's what's up
yes.
with what you're about to hear, which is a podcast about TV and also about, you know, the food we ate over Christmas.
This is a very Christmassy episode.
We're in fact doing all Christmas episodes yeah. of television
we're
shows.
We're going to talk about Christmas episodes of TV shows. I'm going to talk about my my newly found Hallmark Channel addiction.
Haven't you talked about that already, though?
Yes, but there have been movies that I have not talked about yet that premiered on the Hallmark Channel.
And that you cannot see anymore because it's over.
Oh, no, no. It's still happening.
Is it?
I tuned in the other day, and it was still like wall-to-wall Christmas movies.
It's like 5 days after Christmas.
Well, maybe after like the new year it
maybe
slows
it goes
down,
to the new year.
But I was shocked that like on the 27th or 28th, it was still like...
Wall-to-wall.
Wall-to-wall.
Wow.
Like Lacey Chabert learns to make cookies.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
I in terms of Christmas media, I give myself until New Year's Eve.
Okay.
To consume it, to think about it, to talk about it. And this episode is proof of that because it's like 5 days after Christmas and we're finally getting around to doing
right. The
episode where we talk about Christmas television,
mm-hmm.
which we have been watching every day, pretty much, since Thanksgiving.
Yes, we just haven't devoted an episode to it
yet. And setting it aside, setting those little notes aside.
Right.
And waiting for this episode.
Right. Where should we start? How about with the Kojak we watched last night?
What's the last thing he says in the episode?
Love thy neighbor, baby!
So, okay. First, explain Kojak and Telly Savalas to anyone who is not old.
Right.
Like you and me.
Okay, Telly Savalas was a popular character actor. I believe he was in The Dirty Dozen. He was one of the Blofelds in the 007 series.
And yes.
One of my personal favorites on Her Majesty's Secret Service, which is, incidentally, the only Christmas-set 007 movie.
Yes.
And he is probably most popular, most famous for a long-running detective show that he did in the 1970s called Kojak.
Right.
And the shtick was he was bald, he said baby a lot, and he sucked on a lollipop because he quit smoking.
The baby thing became his signature, though.
Yeah, who loves you, baby?
Who loves you, baby?
Yeah.
And was that a thing he said in the show?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a show signature.
I was too young... And I assume you were too.
Yeah, I never really watched
to watch Kojak. It was it was on later at night for grown-ups. It was, you know, a gritty New York cop show.
But it was part of the culture, you know, like there's that joke in Foul Play.
Oh yeah, it was he was part of the culture.
Yes, he was.
He was everywhere.
Yeah, and like, you know, there's that
He was like a sex symbol and he was considered an unusual one.
Yes, cuz he was bald and, you know, older.
Was he older?
Maybe
in his 30s
older.
Or 40s, maybe probably. But he was skinhead bald.
He'd been around since the 60s at least, so he was...
Had a real suave way of talking.
Yeah, he was very TV Rat Pack.
And was always taking off his shirt, if that's my memory.
Really?
He was frequently shirtless in print.
Okay, that I don't know. But
well, because I was a young homosexual,
you
any shirtless man in popular culture made me notice him.
Gotcha.
And when I did notice him, I thought, why do I want to keep looking at this? Like, he wasn't an especially attractive man.
No.
But
he had swagger.
But he had swagger, and the ladies loved him. He put out albums.
That's right, yes.
Sang songs on Merv Griffin and Mike Douglas and...
As I was trying to say before you interrupted me twice.
Okay.
There's that joke in...
I'm sure I had a very good reason to interrupt you twice.
Three times.
And that third time as well.
There was a joke in Foul Play where they have the car... They steal a taxi that has the Japanese tourists in back. And Goldie Hawn's trying to explain to them that they're in a police chase. And finally, what they don't speak any English, but what they finally understand is Kojak Bang Bang.
Oh, that's right. I do remember that.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Kojak was a big thing in the 70s. And yeah, I had never seen it. And, oh my God, it is so 70s, this show.
No, it very
it's
is.
So violent.
It's violent. It's shot in that moody, shadowy, dark way.
That's
so much...
That gritty, like, New York has gone to hell period, you know?
Yeah.
Which means that, like, blocks away, like, Lydia Lunch was performing or something. You know?
Yeah.
It's that same period. Yes. The period of New York that they fawn over in documentaries about how, like, all the artists could afford to move there because it was so cheap, blah, 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 was also the same time as all the cop
people
shows were
being
like,
murdered on the street.
This is a hellhole,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So this was the Christmas episode.
Full disclosure.
Which had a very poetic name, something like How Heavy the Frost or something.
Yeah. Full disclosure, I fell asleep.
You did.
About 20 minutes into this. And at about the 35-minute mark, I woke up again and said, guess what? I'm going to bed. Tell me how this ends.
And it ended with, love thy neighbor, baby.
Love thy neighbor, baby.
So let's see. A guy walks into a bar and shoots
a lady,
and then gets wrestled to the ground by somebody, and then gets shot himself.
And then everyone in the bar continues to go about their business.
Yeah. Oh yeah. How cruel the frost, how bright the stars.
Yeah.
Is the title of the episode from 1975. So
that's a good title for an episode.
It is.
I like that title.
It is. So we gotta find the guy with the gun who is bleeding and who holds pharmacist at gunpoint, steals his list of doctors and is like running around with a gun trying to find somebody to bandage him up. Meanwhile, there's this other guy who his rich girlfriend is worried he's going to rob somebody to buy her a Christmas present because he's poor and she's rich and she bought him something when she wasn't supposed to. And then also, oh God, there's like 8 things going on in this episode. What's fascinating about it,
including Telly Savalas sexually harassing one of the witnesses.
Yes, that's true. And then also you've got like three.
He says she has...
She's a dynamite lady or something, right?
And that she has crazy ankles.
Oh, that's right. But this episode is a jackpot.
Which he could say anything.
Yes.
And get it.
1975.
He could say anything and get it. It didn't matter what he was complimenting.
It didn't matter.
The woman would be like, oh, Telly. My ankles? Really?
The Players Club, baby. He did ads for something called the Players Club, whatever that was. It got you discounts on hotel rooms in Vegas.
Yes.
Anyway, a jackpot of future TV stars this episode, because Veronica Hamill of Hill Street Blues pops up as a recent Greek emigre.
Yeah.
John Larroquette from Night Court as a sailor who is in love with one of the women who is the witness to the shooting.
Yes.
And Edward James Olmos as a chatty bartender with lots of exposition.
I went to bed, and I'm just about drifting off to sleep. And my phone is on the table next to the bed. And it's on mute, but I can hear it when it vibrates. And for some reason, it vibrated extra loud.
Hmm. And because it was for me. Zzz,
zzz. And then I thought, "What? Who's texting me? It's 9:30.
Well, you usually are looking at your phone after you go to bed, so I figured there was a good chance you were still
I turn awake. Off the light, I scroll through Twitter until I start to drowse off.
Right.
And I've got my brightness down, as recommended by many sleep study people.
Yes.
Okay. Also night vision.
Right.
The night thing,
The night canopy.
The night canopy on the phone that
makes everything sepia.
Turns it sepia, yeah. And I put it down, and I was drifting off, and I had to, and I pick it up because I'm like, who's texting me? Everyone knows. Don't talk to me after like 8 o'clock at night. All it says is the text from you, young Edward James Olmos, and I just like, what does that mean? What are you talking about?
I'm trying to tell you what you were missing.
Do I resemble him? Like.
On the Kojak. He was on the
Kojak. So, yes, continue. So who else was in this?
That episode? Was it. Those were the main people. And the guy who played the pharmacist was this old guy who I don't know his name, but if you saw his face, you'd be like, oh, that guy. He was like, as one blog I was reading about Christmas episode said, you'd know his face. He played every old Jew on television from 1970 to 1985.
So I'm looking up How Cruel the Frost, How Bright the Stars to see if there's any from? Kind of literary reference, but all it comes up, what comes up on Google is Kojak.
Oh, wow. So it's not like they got that from Coleridge.
Like maybe they invented it for the show.
Wow.
Yeah.
Heavy, man.
Right. All right. So that's it for that episode.
Yes. But it was pretty Christmassy, though, I have to say. They worked in, like, there was a party and a gift exchange and, you know.
A Kojak Christmas.
Yeah. A very Kojak Christmas.
Before that, we tried. Oh, God. We tried.
One of Dave's childhood favorites.
No.
Wait, what are we talking about then?
Love Boat.
Oh.
Love Boat was one of my teen nemesis. Okay,
nemesis. I thought we were talking about something else, which we'll get to momentarily.
Go on.
Well, no, there were... We tried to watch a Love Boat episode, and I...
Mid-80s, 86.
Yeah, and I had tried watching another Love Boat episode, both set at Christmas. Both painful. I used to love that show when I was like...
How old were you?
I was watching it, I was in the early seasons.
When did it begin, and how old were you when it began?
It started like 76, 77, I want to
And say. What was your, you, so you I'll like, look that up. Okay. What was your fascination with that show at that age?
Just because it was shiny and, you know, on a night when I was probably at home because I was a small child.
It started in 87, it ended in... started in 77, it ended in 87.
Yeah, so I watched it. So yeah, I was 10 when it came on. I don't think I watched the original TV movie that it was based on, but once it became a series, I remember watching it pretty regularly. Like, cause Saturday nights, it was Love Boat and Fantasy Island. Like that was...
This was the episode we watched, The Christmas Cruise, parts 1 and 2.
Yeah, 2 hours!
2 hours was from 1986 during the final season.
Yeah.
The Ted McGinley years.
Right. I was in college at this point. And this was
when... And that's not... I'm not being funny. That is literally the Ted McGinley years. And Marion Ross. They took two people from Happy Days.
Yes.
Who, by the way, Ted McGinley came in late in Happy Days to fix up Happy Days as well. They took Marion Ross from Happy Days, Ted McGinley from Happy Days, switched them over to the Love Boat.
Yeah. And I had definitely stopped. Well, I mean, I was in college for that, but I was not watching Love Boat anymore. Like Julie,
how long did you watch the Love
Julie
Boat?
Was back. Like, that's how late this episode was. I probably watched, I would say, by no later than like 81, 82, maybe. You know, like the first 4 or 5 seasons or so, but. But I'm younger than you, you know. Like, by the time I went to college,
this is that crucial 3-year difference,
exactly.
Because in 1977, I was 13.
Right, I was 10.
And we've discussed this before. The things that turn your head in the culture at age 10 are not the same things that turn your head in the culture at 13.
Absolutely.
And 1977, me saw the Love Boat and thought, ugh. No, I'll never watch this show.
Well, look, it had Murray from the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Uh-huh.
That was a plus. And it just, I don't know, it was huge in the culture. And here's the thing, I watched a lot of network TV at that point, which is frankly all there was. We didn't have cable remotely yet.
Right.
And, you know, like that was just one of those shows that was just sort of, that had kind of permeated everything, and you would always see ads for it. And we were talking about, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson's dad, the voice of ABC in the late 70s, on the Love Boat, you know. Yeah, that was just the thing. And then Fantasy Island came on after. So that was my whole Saturday night right there.
Very much like Golden Girls.
This was your symbol, your emblem of failure.
It was an emblem of failure for me because 77 was my last year of middle school. I began high school in the fall of 1978.
Right.
So the thing was, if you were home on Saturday night, you were not popular.
Right.
You had nothing to do. you had no friends to go do things with. So if I was home on a Saturday night, that meant either reading a book, which was not what you wanted. And I loved reading books as a kid, and I've been a lifelong reader, but not on Saturday night, because right. that meant something akin to homework.
Right.
Like, it's one step away from homework.
Right.
If you're doing that on Saturday night. That was what my stupid kid had thought at the time. And so what was on TV Saturday nights in those years was The Love Boat. And if I was home, stuck in front of the TV with The Love Boat, I had failed as a human being in life.
I didn't start high school until like 1980. So,
and The Love Boat was my punishment because it was so effing bad.
For the first few years of that show, that was like a normal thing where probably what would happen would be on a Saturday afternoon, I would hang out with a friend of mine, we'd go to a movie, whatever. And then yes. Saturday night, unless they were like spending the night, if I was just hanging out at home, I would watch The
Love
Boat.
You were watching TV.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we made it through 15 minutes
yeah.
of this god-awful 2-hour Love Boat.
Yeah.
Where Leslie Caron and Leslie Caron's daughter, Jennifer Hall, pop star.
Yes.
Put that word in quotes. Pop star Jennifer Hall.
Jennifer Caron Hall is how right. she was credited. Yeah.
Right. Play... It's basically they're doing Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. They're con artists. They're looking to get, you know.
Well, they're not con artists in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes.
I know,
but they're doing a mother daughter Lady Eve, actually.
I know. But like they're out to get a rich guy and get him for his money.
Okay.
So yes, it's not Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. I know I misspoke, but at the same time, it's like that.
Well, it's totally Lady Eve because you've got Peter Scolari in the dorky millionaire role.
Okay, I'm completely wrong. It's the Lady Eve. I'll shut up.
And they are mother-daughter grifters, much like that terrible Sigourney Weaver.
You'd think I would have come up with the Lady Eve reference myself, given how it became such a part of my life.
That was the movie where we saw with a group of friends where it was observed that Dave White sort of talks like Eugene Paulette.
I do not. Where's my breakfast? No. Eugene Paulette, may he rest in peace, an amazing character actor, heard kind of a froggy voice. Like that.
It was very low. Like, okay, here's him at the end of...
He has more in common with Harvey Fierstein.
Right. At the end of The Gang's All Here, there's a song called A Journey to a Star that Alice Faye has sung earlier in the film, and now then, like, everybody in the movie gets a line of it, and Eugene Paulette says, A journey to a star would not be very far. That's what Eugene Paulette sounded like.
All right. Well, it was pointed out during a screening of The Lady Eve by our awful, awful friend,
Vinny Lopez.
That all he did was point to the screen and go, that's you. And I was like, I will choke the life out of you right now. But it stuck.
Yes.
And then suddenly he was doing impersonations of my voice, and then suddenly everyone else was. All of our so-called friends.
Wait, are you telling me that nobody in your life had ever done impersonations of your voice prior to that moment?
Prior to that moment, no.
I find that
not even you.
Exceedingly hard to believe.
Not even you. You had
fellow teachers didn't do it?
Nope.
Wow.
Nope. Nobody. They had a little bit more respect for me than, as I called them, our so-called friends. The terrible people that I have surrounded myself with in life as friends. It's all on them. And you, because you do it too now. Peer pressured into what is essentially bullying me every day of my life.
Poor you.
I'm anti-bullying. I'm anti all of you guys. So anyway...
The Quran.
In The Lady Eve, Eugene Paulette bangs on the table and yells, where's my breakfast? Over and over again.
Yeah. Okay.
So we didn't watch it.
And I mean, we
fast-forwarded through yes. to the end to see if Peter Scolari was somehow some kind of Christmas angel. Because... Because it was set up in such a way that he was such a sore thumb on the boat.
He didn't seem to be an actual human being.
That he didn't even seem really human. And yeah. So I thought, well, there's something wrong here. And he's going to be like the angel of Christmas or something. Because in these TV special episodes for Christmas, there's always something supernatural.
Yes.
But not always, but there is often. That's one of the tropes that you'll see from time to time. Something supernatural coming in to play in an otherwise non-supernatural themed
show.
Like, oh, look, it was an actual angel. Oh, he was the real Santa Claus.
Right.
You know. No, that's not what happens here. Peter Scolari is just some dork.
Who's a gajillionaire.
Who's a super billionaire who winds up falling in love with Leslie Caron's daughter.
Yes. There were other subplots, the but end. I can't remember what they... John Biner is a depressed Santa.
John Biner is the depressed Santa who had just gotten out of prison, but he was framed.
Yeah, and some... who knows? The other one that I tried to watch involved... Oops, we've accidentally hired three Santas.
Right.
Played by Avery Schreiber, Ray Walston, who will be coming up again later in this episode, and Scatman Crothers.
Okay.
And then other stupid Christmas things involving like Anne Francis and I forget what else. But anyway, yeah, The Love Boat is a terrible show. This is not news, but yes,
it's only saving grace. The Andy Warhol episode, the Dallas Cowboy Cheerleaders episode,
The one where all the old MGM stars show up is pretty great.
No, it's not. I've seen it. You're wrong.
It's worth it for the moment where Della Reese says regarding Ann Miller, "Give me a hammer and I'll break your hair."
Okay, how much time of television did you have to sit through to get to that one good line?
And it's like later era Van Johnson where he's not even really trying to hide how gay he is.
Hey, shh.
He's dead.
He was.
You can't defame the dead.
But that's true.
Also, he was a total gay.
He was a total gay. Yeah. Yes. And before The Love Boat, we watched one of my childhood favorite programs, Julia.
Yes.
Julia was a show that starred Diane Carroll.
Right.
She played a nurse whose husband had been killed in Vietnam.
Right.
So she was a widow. She was raising her 6-year-old son alone. Mm-hmm. And it was the first sitcom.
It was the first TV show at all with a black female protagonist who was not a domestic.
Yes, because there had been a show called Beulah early in the 50s, I guess.
Yeah, I think it started in radio and then made its way to television.
And who played Beulah?
I want to say it's Ethel Waters?
No, I don't remember who played Beulah. But that was the first sitcom where a black woman was the lead, but she played a maid. So Julia was the first sitcom where a black woman was the lead, and she played...
She was a professional.
A non-maid. It wasn't on very long. 2 seasons, maybe 3, I think. And I was deeply into it, although I barely remember this. All I know is that before the Brady Bunch and the Partridge Family,
both Ethel Waters and Louise Beavers played Beulah. I knew it was one of them, but I didn't know it was both of them.
Before the Brady Bunch and the Partridge Family came along, Julia and Lassie and Gentle Ben and Nanny and the Professor.
You had a lot of jams.
That was my jam, yeah. And so Gentle Ben was about a kid and his pet bear.
Ben!
And was it Clint Howard?
Yes.
Little baby Clint Howard. Mm-hmm. And then Nanny the Professor was about a supernatural nanny.
Yes. Phoebe Figalilli, played by Juliet Mills.
Lassie was about Lassie.
Yes.
And then, but Julia was about this lady and her kid. And I was really into it. And I was too young. I had not yet started school. But I was sort of enchanted by the Julia lunchbox that was available at the store. Although it was, you know, I was 4 when the show came on, so there was no need for me to have a lunchbox. But the this episode proved something to me. The episode we watched was called I'm Dreaming of a Black Christmas. Mm-hmm. The point being that Corey, Julia's 6-year-old son,
right,
understands Santa to be black. And then the white kid, his best friend, who lives across the hall in the apartment building, thinks Santa is white. So, Julia and the white kid's parents, they come together and they figure out a way to make black Santa show up for Corey.
Is that what happens?
I don't remember exactly. Because here's what does happen.
There's a black Santa. Two black Santas
wind up showing up. But you don't exactly know what's going on because halfway through the show, something that never happens in the show happens. Diane Carroll begins singing. Yeah. Now, before she was on this sitcom, Diane Carroll was a singer and remained a singer before and after Julia. But she begins singing Christmas carols, and for the next 5 to 7 minutes, the action is all without dialogue as she sings a song. And at one point, she's looking, singing directly into the camera.
Right, while there's like wacky hijinks with the Santas in the hallway figuring out who's going to knock on the door and stuff.
And then Black Santa shows up and everyone's happy and they all get presents. The end. The Christmas tree falls over.
Yes. Also, the kid...
What a terrible show this was.
And the kid who played Corey, who famously said years later that he put on weight on that show because all they ever had her doing was giving him snacks.
Yeah.
Is not a very good child actor. And as you pointed out, most TV shows who have a not good child actor know better than to give him pages of dialogue.
This kid has so much to say.
So much dialogue.
And it all sounds
like it's set at the same level as the thing that he said before and is about to say next.
Every time he opens his mouth, it reminds me of the peanut strip.
The star that showed on Bethlehem still shines for us today.
Yes. Where Linus is at the Christmas pageant and he can't remember his lines, and Lucy is threatening physical violence if he does not remember his lines. And then he yells out, monotone, big voice, what you his just line. Said. But that's how this kid delivers his lines. He's still alive.
Yes.
I mean...
So is Diane Carroll.
I'm sure his feelings wouldn't be hurt if he knew that we thought he was not a very good child actor, but...
I think he's got some perspective on it.
Yeah, probably.
Can we talk about Diane Carroll for a second? Because I feel like now any star over the age of, like, 55, we have to relish and embrace and... praise while they're still around.
Yes,
because
everyone died this week. Everybody died this week.
And we'll talk about that and on Linoleum Knife.
Maybe we'll talk. Yeah, we'll talk about that on Linoleum Knife.
Because these are film people more than TV people. But you know, yeah, Diane Carroll, a dynamo and in a very difficult period to be a black entertainer in mainstream America. Not that it's ever stopped being one.
Right.
But, I mean, she talks about how. Like when they were making Hurry Sundown, how they had to deal with Klansmen, you know, in Louisiana in the middle of the sticks where they were shooting this thing in the bayou, you know. I mean, this is a woman who has like endured some stuff, and she was Dominique Devereaux. Which, come on, go to YouTube and watch some Dominique Devereaux scenes from Dynasty when she smacks Joan Collins.
All you have to do is. Put Diane Carroll in Wikipedia. Her first name is spelled D-I-A-H-A-N-N, an unusual spelling of the name. And then it'll give you a link, a wiki link to Dominique Devereaux.
Nice.
She's 81, by the way.
Wow. Didn't I give you like her memoir?
You did.
Have you read it?
I have it right over here on the shelf.
Okay, cool.
Eventually, one day, I'm going to read it.
Okay.
Maybe even before she dies.
That would be great.
Yeah.
So yes, if you love a celebrity,
she's going to be 100. She's going to be Dina Merrill. Dina Merrill is
still alive.
Dina Merrell, star of White Christmas, and
no Desk Set.
I'm sorry, not White Christmas. Desk Set. Forgive me. I had a vision of Desk Set in my head, and I said White Christmas anyway. Co-star of Desk Set.
Yes.
She's 96, something like that. Wow. She's very old and. Well, you know what?
You know why she
being
also
a billionaire,
crazy rich.
Being a billionaire keeps you rich, keeps you young.
Yes.
Yeah, keeps you alive.
Yeah, I'm sure she gets like stem cells.
It also keeps you rich
on a daily basis.
I'm tripping all over them today. Yeah.
So yeah, Julia,
just like I did on the Sewers of Paris episode that we happen to be on this week.
Yes.
And Matt didn't edit around us at all. He just let the flubs fly.
We're just so charming. do check out the year end episode of Sewers of Paris. Thank you, Matt.
We're on for the first 8 minutes or something.
Talking about our favorite stuff from 2016.
We both talked about a favorite movie and then a favorite.
You talked about a favorite song.
I talked about a favorite song, and you talked about something else.
A TV moment.
Yeah.
What else? Oh, well, speaking of Ray Walston, we watched a Bionic Christmas Carol episode of The $6 Million Man.
Did we wrap up Julia by talking about what a not very good show it is? Yeah, okay.
So, I have very specific memories of watching this particular episode as a kid, where Steve Austin, you know, and again, it's like in the very small grab bag of Christmas ideas that TV shows tend to have.
Yes.
Christmas Carol / It's a Wonderful Life ripoffs tend to play heavily. And so this is one where Steve uses his bionic powers to convince mean rich guy Ray Walston to stop being such a jerk to poor Dick Sargent.
So tedious.
Although it did have Quinn Cummings and Adam Rich.
If I never see another adaptation of A Christmas Carol, like adapted to some contemporary setting with some twist.
Kevin Hart is doing one as we speak.
What's happening?
There is a Kevin Hart Scrooge thing that is in production.
A movie?
Yeah.
So for Christmas of 2017?
Probably, yeah.
Okay. I will let that come along because it might be funny.
Yes.
Scrooged, after all, I really like the Bill Murray film from the late 80s.
A Diva's Christmas Carol.
Here's what I like about A Diva's Christmas Carol. Kathy Griffin.
You don't like the fact that the Ghost of Christmas Past is VH1's Behind the Music?
That's actually kind of
funny, too.
That's pretty brilliant. That's kind of funny, too. All right. But otherwise, I'm not... It bores me because, you know, Dick Sargent was on Bewitched.
He was the second Darren.
Yeah. Dick Sargent's name here is
also a gay.
Bob Crandall or something like that. I was like, why? Why does it have to be like this? Why can't anyone lift a finger of imagination and do something different?
And Ray Walston is Mr. Budge.
Exactly. Here's why you want to watch this show ever. Lee Majors was the perfect man for the 1970s, and here's why.
He could rock a leisure suit.
Every man in the 1970s did not button his shirt. We're going back to the Telly Savalas thing here. The 1970s were a magical time in men's clothing. Men stopped buttoning their shirts. The cool thing to do was have your shirt open really deeply.
Yes.
Like, just above the navel, above your belly button.
Because it was made of breathable Kiana. Yeah. And so, you know, it wasn't going to move.
So it was cool. You were a cool guy at the discotheque.
Mm-hmm.
At work, apparently. Like, anywhere. I don't know. I was a child, so I was not the one who was walking around with my shirt open. But grown men were doing this.
With the, like, collar points out to your shoulders.
Yeah. Well,
on top of lapels that were out to
your
shoulders.
It worked best if you had physical attributes to show the world. And Lee Majors had physical attributes to show the world. He had a very nice chest, and it was always on display. always. No matter where you look, on the $6 Million Man, on the cover of People magazine, he and Farrah, they joined the jogging craze. And then
There was a moment when Lee Majors and Farrah Fawcett Majors were like the Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie of their moment. Like these two incredibly gorgeous physical specimens.
Yeah.
Sadly, they never had
made children together.
Because that's some DNA jackpot.
Well, right, you know what would have happened?
It would have skipped the
generation. That kid would have self-destructed.
Well, that too, I suppose, yes. That was a lot of pressure.
Yeah. And so...
probably just as well.
But yeah, so... He walks in, first scene, shirt wide open. Merry Christmas from Lee Majors' chest. Last scene of the show, he walks in again with a big gift for what's-his-face.
Oscar Goldman.
Different outfit, different shirt, wide open. Happy New Year from Lee Majors' chest. It was a good chest, you guys. Very good.
Yes.
I didn't even really care about the $6 million man. And by this point, I was a little older. And so I was taking notice of the fact that I was noticing shirtless men.
Ah.
And he was always shirtless in the culture. He was Telly Savalas could not keep up with Lee Majors being shirtless in the culture. Google Lee Majors shirtless and 1,000 pictures come up.
See, again, being a little younger than you, I was totally into the $6 million man, and I didn't necessarily consciously connect it with the fact that I just wanted to see Lee Majors' chest. The person that I think of as being shirtless in that period is Robert Conrad.
Robert Conrad was always shirtless, but he was shirtless back in the 60s.
Yes, but still in the 70s.
He could not
stop.
Baba
Black Sheep.
Could not stop taking off his shirt.
Yeah.
Robert Conrad. Again, he had reason.
Sure.
You wanted to see him that way.
And he wanted to be seen.
And he wanted to be seen that way. Yeah.
We also saw the, I don't know if Good Times had multiple Christmas episodes, but this was the one which...
Esther Rolle was never shirtless on Good Times.
She was not. This actually overlaps with is an episode that is mentioned in Reality Bites, because it's the one where Penny gets arrested for shoplifting.
Right. Right.
Because all of her money gets stolen at the department store when she's about to buy Willona a necklace. And so she tries to steal the necklace, and the authorities are called right when Willona is trying to adopt her, and Alice Ghostly plays the social worker. And this was definitely an episode where the thing that drives me crazy about reruns on television is that they all get chopped into 2016 ad rate. You know, slots.
Yeah.
And so you have these shows that were, you know, that ran 24 minutes when now a sitcom runs 22 or 21 or whatever. And so things get lopped out, and important scenes that, you know, I guess the ones that they decided are the first to go are the ones that are just like exposition or plotting or story or whatever. So now you can watch an entire half hour sitcom and not even be sure how we got from point A to point B, because like there's some connective tissue missing. And this one definitely had some like, wait, so they arrested her, but then they don't, who's the, now she's adopted? Well, great. Like, something's missing here.
A lot of things were missing. They chopped it up in a way that made the episode actually incomprehensible.
Yes. I mean, not that this
and
was...
And not funny anyway.
And not that it was Voltaire to begin with, but I mean, it was a hot mess, this trying to suss out what was going on in this episode. But it's always fun to watch baby Janet Jackson.
Yes, because she was adorable.
Yes.
We, it was terrible. That episode is terrible. Those later seasons of Good Times are terrible.
Yeah.
Esther Rolle and John Amos were like, we're getting out of here.
Bye.
Yeah.
Yeah, once Willona has to do the heavy lifting, I mean, she was a great supporting character, but you could not build a thing around her.
Then we watched the Christmas 1975 episode of Cher's variety show, her standalone.
Yes. Yeah, so post Sunny.
Yeah. Okay, outfits. Outfits.
Bob Mackie.
Outfits. It's outfits. Because once you turn up the volume, the only thing worth listening to is her saying.
It's funny that Sonny and Cher like had a moment where they were genuine pop stars.
Yeah.
And then that Cher could be taken seriously enough in the culture to run with the likes of Greg Allman after doing these variety shows that are so hokey and corny and schmaltzy. I mean, this is stuff that like Bob, this is stuff that Bob Hope was doing. Like, just so like playing to the what we would now think of as like the Branson audience. You know? I mean, the Lennon sisters were on this Cher Christmas special, for God's sake.
Yeah.
And the only time that the show gets remotely watchable is at the very end, when they're sort of doing, they're pretending like it's the 1930s and it's a ballroom and they're doing a live radio show. And then they sing Christmas carols.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, fine. Why did we have to wait the entire hour to get to this? Mind you, this moment also includes young Chastity Bono getting trotted out in like pin curls and a pinafore and stuff. And I'm just thinking, oh, this is going to be like the fodder for future therapy sessions.
It's a very telling moment when she comes out because first of all, she acts like she has no interest in being there. And then Cher says, "What do you want for Christmas?" And she's what, five?
Five or six, yeah.
And she says, "Race cars and a Planet of the Apes treehouse." And I'm watching it, I'm thinking, me too, Chaz. That's also what I, a boy, wanted. So,
also
fascinating.
Good branding there, because I believe the Planet of the Apes TV show was airing on CBS at the same time.
Well, if you were a smart child, regardless of your gender,
yes,
you wanted
that treehouse,
the Planet of the Apes treehouse.
Yes,
yeah.
But no, I mean, Chaz talks in his memoir about having to get dressed up for that show and getting trotted out and all the weird sort of performance of femininity. But I have never seen a girlier Chaz outfit.
Well, yeah, on one of these shows. They she looked like a little doll.
Yeah, like they like literally was like, all right, Shirley Temple, you know. And,
yeah.
And it's just, it's like when you think about performances of gender, like that's the further limit. Like when you're a 6-year-old kid, that's as girly as you get, is that Shirley Temple look.
Oh yeah. Oh no. Our friend Jack posted a photo of himself when he was 4 or 5, on Facebook.
Right.
And he, when he was that age, you know, it was like for a studio photo or whatever.
Right. His Olin Mills.
His mother or dad, you know, dressed him up in the girliest, he's transgender, sorry. He's trans, yeah, okay. So they dressed him up in the girliest little outfit in the world. And he looks adorable, but, you know, it's a strange thing to go back and see that.
Right.
And to wonder to yourself, what must that be like? To be a child and to know sort of inside, this is not me. And yet people are just putting this on me.
And on the one hand, you think, okay, well, at least by the time we grew up, like, you know, if little girls wanted to wear pants, they could, nobody cared, wasn't a big deal. But but still, like, there's all this stuff where, like, when you look at toys for kids and like all the hot pinks and purples for all the girl stuff, including if they want to, like, play, you know, Batgirl or whatever,
I know.
That whole thing about the whole issue about the girl who wanted the Easy Bake Oven to make, you know, one in less girly colors for her brother who wanted one. Like, just so much of that stuff is just so ingrained so early and so leaned upon. It's a weird construct.
Yeah. So, again, it is the testament. It is a testament to the power of Cher as an entity,
right,
in the galaxy, that you can still watch that show and salvage some pleasure from it.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't matter what terrible thing she's singing it.
Yes,
really well, and that's why dudes like Greg Allman found their way to her.
I suppose, yeah.
All those, like, rock and roll guys, they saw her and they saw their equal. They saw a woman who was put into a situation but was basically always better than everything she was put into.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's weird how badly those shows hold up. Like, how schmaltzy they were, especially when you think of, like, the Captain and Tennille.
Yes.
Had a huge booming pop career that they now say was derailed by their variety show.
Yes.
And how schmaltzy it was. So it's like you really had to have something else going on to overcome that stuff, which Cher did.
Yeah. And within a few years, she was in Silkwood. And so.
Right. Or come back to the Five and Dimes You Meet Ian first. Yeah. But totally. Yeah, you're right.
So then we watched 227.
Oh God!
Mary's Christmas.
Last year, you may recall, so if you're a long time
also
listener,
very bad.
Yeah. Last year, we watched the one.
Can we just say 227 was a crap show?
It was a terrible
always,
show.
Yeah. Always.
Yes.
Okay.
As much as we love Jack Hay, it was a dumb show. Last year, we saw the one with the plot of, no one's coming to my Christmas party. Oh, no, everyone's coming to my Christmas party.
Yeah.
This one was the plot of, I don't even remember. Like, the church burned down, but we're going to do the nativity play outside?
The church, yeah. They had to raise money for the church, and then they were going to raise money with the new nativity show, and somehow that didn't happen, and everybody wound up at the apartment in the nativity outfits. The end. Absolutely pointless.
Given that Regina King is now a permanent fixture of my annual Christmas because I have to watch this Christmas, yes, and she's in it.
Yes.
It's interesting to see her like baby Regina King on 227.
She worked, a terrible show. She worked since she was even younger than that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. She's been an actor like since a diapers, I think.
Wow.
Yeah. She's since actual childhood.
She's still out there. She was apparently really good. She directs on The Catch. She was on American Crime, which I didn't see, but I heard she was really good in it.
She's great all the time.
Yeah, good on her.
But there's no making 227 good.
No.
Until Jack Kay shows up.
Right.
Jack Kay shows up and says things in that Jack Kay kind of way.
Oh, Mary.
and everyone laughs, and that she's the gimmick,
yeah,
of the show. Everyone else is her straight man.
Right.
And except for the older grandma lady,
right, yeah,
who has some zingers every once in a while,
and apparently, like, I think,
and I'm sorry, I'm blanking on her name.
Marla Gibbs, of course, was like, "This is my vehicle," and was not thrilled about the fact that Jack Kay very quickly established herself as the.
It was Marla Gibbs's show, but Marla Gibbs wasn't the. She wasn't being Florence. Jack Kay was being Florence,
right?
And Florence and Jack Kay and Florida Evans before, you know, Good Times. Before Good Times, the character of Florida Evans was the maid on Maude,
right,
and had all the funny lines.
And then on Good Times, she became the straight person, and JJ got
had all the funny lines. Yeah. So the second banana with the good quips is who has the funny delivery,
right?
Urkel.
Yeah.
Jack and Karen.
Karen.
On Will and Grace. Will and Grace weren't funny.
Yeah.
Will, the character, Grace, the character, they were not the funny people on the show.
No, Jack and Karen.
Jack and Karen were the funny people on the show. And so, you know, if you're going to be the star, be happy with being number one on the call sheet and making the most money.
Right. I mean, like, when you look at the Mary Tyler Moore show, I mean, yeah, she got to be funny, but she was very generous about letting Sue Ann be funny and letting Murray be funny.
Everyone.
And Ted and, you know,
everyone.
Rhoda. So
Mary Tyler Moore's show is like a lightning bolt striking somewhere where an ensemble has equal weight. It's the star's show, but it's truly an ensemble show, and everyone is funny, and everyone matters.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, again, here's the lesson. You know, it was very much to Mary Tyler Moore's benefit that show became as great as it did and lasted for as long as it did and as beloved as it is because Mary Tyler Moore didn't insist on getting all the laughs and always being at the center of everything. She, you know, she could have put her foot down about how much the rest of that cast got to do, and she wisely let them have their moments, and that's what made the show overall and the show that bears her name, you know, so great.
Correct. Speaking of Maude.
Oh, right.
We watched the 1977 episode Maude's Christmas Surprise.
Mm.
Someone was supposed to leave a ham on Maude's front doorstep, and instead they left a baby. And then they all interpret it as a miracle, and the baby is sent to them to teach them the true meaning of Christmas, and...
This was late period Maude, because she was on her third maid.
Correct.
She'd already lost Florida to Good Times,
yep,
and then Mrs. Naugatuck had left, and so now we were at what's her name, Victoria Butterfield?
I don't remember.
Who was never very fun.
Not, she wasn't funny at all.
Yeah.
No. And this episode was terrible. And I loved Maude.
Yes.
Bad episode.
Mm.
And
I mean, and to be fair,
you kept wanting them to someone please bring the ham back.
To be fair, Christmas episodes are not the best way to judge any show because we had Jim Colucci on a while ago to talk about his book Golden Girls Forever, and he said that like the TV writers' rooms would just dread the Christmas episode because, you know, they would generally have to be sort of sentimental and they had to be very self-contained, and you had to have these reasons of why the characters were, you know, if they weren't related to each other, why were they all hanging out together on this holiday?
Right. Yes.
Know? At least on Maud, they were neighbors, like, so it made sense.
Cheers.
Why,
you know, yeah. Like, why are you all...
Yeah, friends.
Why are you all at the bar? Yeah. Go where you go.
Yeah.
Lots of our good friends do not spend Christmas with us.
Right.
They're off doing other things with their actual families. Yeah. We watched The Mod Squad.
Oh, yes.
The episode called Christy.
Short for Christmas.
A boring child with a stuffed...
Sketchy dad.
Sketchy dad and a stuffed dog that has been turned into a jewelry mule.
Yes, which obviously somebody on that show watched Night of the Hunter.
Yeah. She winds up on Pete's doorstep. I'm sorry. Let's talk about what Mod Squad is. Yes. I'm sorry. Tell them.
Oh, this was an early Aaron Spelling triumph, if I recall correctly.
Yes.
So, you know, America was divided between the counterculture and the culture, and there was the generation gap, and of course television had to figure out a way to make it all bland and palatable.
Yes.
So the Mod Squad were three young people who looked like hippies and seemed to be like they were from these streets.
But they were narcs.
But they were narcs. They were undercover cops. And they were the good guys and the heroes, even though they were total narcs. And so in this episode, a friend of Pete's shows up with his daughter and parks her there while he goes off to do something. And it turns out he's doing something bad and gets...
Crimes.
He held hostage.
Bad guys are after him. They kidnap him.
Pete's stuck with the daughter for a while. And Pete, for a hippie slash undercover cop, manages to have like the most luxuriously decorated Christmas apartment imaginable.
Like it's Christmas Eve and he's got virtually nothing up for Christmas decorations. But then this kid shows up. And suddenly, there's candy canes everywhere, and a big tree, and garland, and a wreath, and, like, candles, and suddenly, everyone Pete knows has sent him a Christmas card, they're on the mantle. Like, the set decorators must have thought to themselves, let's see how ridiculous we can make this, shall we? Let's amuse ourselves.
Let's Christmas this joint up.
Let's amuse ourselves and see when they tell us to stop. And no one told them to stop.
No
one said it would be illogical for this young mod kind of man who is a single bachelor swinging hot dude who is also an undercover cop.
He does not have a crush made of balsa wood.
On Christmas Eve, he has no actual Christmas decorations up. And by Christmas Day, it's like something exploded.
Yeah, it's a miracle on 34th Street.
So that's actually what the episode is about, to me. About set decorators having a go.
Yeah, I don't even remember like how they resolved the thing with the kid.
Oh, they shoot the bad guy.
Well, yeah, basically, yes.
They shoot the bad guy. The kid gets back with her dad. The end.
Yeah.
There's even a Santa, even some guy dressed as Santa Claus comes along at the end and gives the kid a bunch of presents.
It's like their boss, maybe?
I don't remember.
One of the Mod Squad is Prince's dad from Purple Rain, and then the other one is Rashida Jones's mother.
Yes. Peggy Lipton. Who was on Twin Peaks.
Yes, that too.
Married
to Quincy Jones.
When gorgeous Peggy Lipton was gorgeous young Peggy Lipton, she was Julie on the Mod Squad.
Right.
Yeah. So,
still gorgeous on Twin Peaks, still gorgeous now.
Well, yeah, that's...
And presumably we'll still be gorgeous on the new Twin Peaks that we're getting next year.
I'm so, so excited.
I am tempering...
You are very excited, too.
No, I just, you know, I
you and I get along just fine.
I don't believe in looking too forward to things.
We are of one mind on this topic.
Returns to things.
I don't want to hear no arguments.
I'm just saying
about it.
I'm trying to not raise expectations so that I can be pleasantly surprised.
It's David Lynch. What you got to be? You can raise your expectations for David Lynch.
I don't love everything he does the way you do.
What's wrong with you?
I did not love Inland Empire the way you
Why did. Not?
It's a fault of mine, clearly.
Yeah. Okay. We watched two actually really funny shows that had really funny Christmas episodes.
Oh, yes. Our Miss Brooks.
And My Mother the Car.
Right. I forgot about My Mother the Car.
You need to explain My Mother the Car, which was a real thing. This show is from the 60s, the 1960s. Yeah.
The title kind of says it all. So in the 60s, and I've tried to figure out if this was sort of a post-McCarthy thing or what, but there was a whole breed of sitcom that was like The Neighbors Mustn't Find Out.
Yeah.
The neighbors mustn't find out that I'm a witch. The neighbors mustn't find out that my uncle is a Martian. The neighbors mustn't find out, you know, whatever. This was The Neighbors Mustn't Find Out That My Mother Has Been Reincarnated into my car. Like, it's a 1916 Porter or something.
And she talks to him.
Yeah.
Yeah, from the radio.
From the radio.
Yeah.
She communicates with Jerry Van Dyke, who is the star of the show, and Ann Southern is the voice of the mother. And this is one of those shows that's like so legendarily disastrous that it was a punchline for a long time. Now it's mostly forgotten. But
yeah.
But there was a
they're showing it on Get TV.
Yes, they are.
Is it Get TV or is it Cozy or
Get TV? I think.
Okay,
one of those. Anyway, but for a while there, like My Mother the Car was sort of the go-to, like if you want to talk about a terrible TV show.
A terrible TV show that was actually pretty funny.
But yeah, it holds up better than
like,
you would
think. In a goofy, like, why am I, how can I be watching this sort of way?
I had somehow never seen an episode. Like, I knew of it my entire life, but I'd never sat down and watched My Mother the Car. And so this was the Christmas episode, and it's all about how Jerry Van Dyke and his wife are both taking an art class, and they've both made these hideous things. And what they're really giving each other for Christmas is they're each paying their friend to bid on the other one's art in the auction,
so they can have money. So they can have money to buy the things they want to buy to each other. Is that right?
No, no. They have money that they're supposed to spend on each other.
That's right. That's right.
Instead, it sort of gets to the Magi. They each bribe a friend to go buy the art in the auction,
yeah,
so that they won't have their feelings hurt when no one wants their terrible art.
Yeah.
And then it all gets very complicated in a 60s sitcom kind of way, but there's a running joke about like they're supposed to buy themselves something, I think is what it is, but then they wind up taking it back to get the money to give to the friend to get the art.
Yeah.
So he wants a shaver that will play The Barber of Seville, and she wants this weird thing that you like you stick your hands in
and it automatically manicures you. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, it's wacky.
We're ridiculous made up presents that didn't exist.
Right.
In a Gift of the Magi themed episode, centered around a sitcom in which the guy's mother is a reincarnated automobile and who talks, yes, just like Mr. Ed.
Yeah, exactly. The neighbor mustn't find out I have a talking horse.
Yeah. So it is not a good show, but it is a funny show, and it's a weird show, and it has an amazing theme song.
Oh, yes. Go look that up on YouTube.
Yeah, it's on YouTube. There might be entire episodes on YouTube now that I think about it.
Yeah, and apparently I think one of the running things of the show is, I think, again, Avery Schreiber plays like a car collector who keeps trying to steal the car or take the car away. He is not on this episode.
Here's the interesting thing about this episode. When I'm watching old episodes of this kind of thing with you, the first thing I do is go to IMDb. Because often, old sitcoms from the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, they have people that I've never heard of before and never heard of since.
Right.
Those are always like the secondary people, and they fascinate me because I want to know where they went off to.
Right.
You know, clearly they had some kind of dream. They were going to make it in Hollywood. And they were going to do this, and they were going to do that. And whoa, I got a sitcom, and I'm a regular now, and this is the big break I've been looking for. And then they disappear.
Yeah, or they just do a lot of Murder, She Wrote.
Yeah, and I always want to know who that person is, what they did after, where they are now. Mm-hmm. Are they okay? I always want to know, are they okay? So
did it all turn out
all right? Did it all turn out okay for her or him?
Yeah.
Well, there is a woman on this particular episode of My Mother the Car who plays, I guess, one of the wife's friend
who's going
to bid on the art. And she looked vaguely familiar to me, like maybe I had seen her in some sort of bikini beach party movie or whatever, because she had that look.
That Southern California glow.
Yeah. I looked her up. actress named Chris Noel.
Mm-hmm.
After my mother, the car, she got so involved in USO shows with Vietnam.
Right.
Going to Vietnam for USO shows.
Because her brother was serving or something?
I think so.
Yeah.
That she quit acting and she began working with homeless vets.
Hmm.
She's 75 years old now, living in Florida, still doing it. Like, wow. Still working with homeless veterans. Completely fascinating life that you never knew about because she was never really famous.
Right.
You know?
And it's probably the kind of thing that comes up in conversation, like, oh, well, I was on Mother, My Mother,
I was
the
on
Car
My Mother,
once.
The Car, yeah.
Well, it's like, okay, for example, our friend Lou Harris, who has hired both...
My very first... editor who paid me money.
Yes, he hired you at iFilm. He hired me at The Wrap.
Mm-hmm.
One day, posts a photo of himself as an extra on Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman. I'm like, what?
So, such a small thing that he doesn't even have an IMDb page.
Our friend Brian Boskin, who, if you've heard our extra episode dedicated to the Poseidon Adventure...
Yeah.
After Hairspray Live aired, he like posted some photos of the fact that he was a dancer in the original John Waters Hairspray. How do you not know this about a person?
How is it they don't tell you, hey, check it out. Like, this is a stupid thing I did once. Or in Brian's case, a really cool thing I did once.
Yeah. I mean,
Lou's case, it was dumb because he was playing an extra drunk on Mary
Hartman.
But
still, that's kind of cool. I mean,
it's funny.
But, you know, I mean, granted, I don't walk into every conversation with a new person saying, oh, did you know I was on Jeopardy? You know, I mean, I get it. It's like,
but
you
eventually,
learn things later.
Eventually,
you know?
It comes up because somehow Jeopardy will come up in a topic of conversation, and then you'll be like, I was on Jeopardy and I lost.
It doesn't come up
that
often.
By the way, y'all, if you can get yourself on Jeopardy, do it.
That's true.
Because
even if you lose, you get money.
Even if you lose, even if you come in third,
yes.
Even if you get nothing right, all you have to do is stand behind the podium and you go home with $1,000.
It's true.
Yep.
2,000 if you come in second.
2,000 if you're almost smart.
Oh, that's where we're going with this now?
Well, you know, if you had just been a little smarter, you would have had...
It was all the damn buzzer.
You would,
don't get me started
that's
on that.
That's a nice excuse. That's a nice excuse.
I would love to see how you would fare.
I would
on this.
First of all, I would fall down. I would trip over something and fall down, and then I would leave with $1,000. I'll have you know, a cool thou,
a grand,
yeah,
a G. We also saw the Armis Brooks Christmas 1952 episode. I want to say
Armis Brooks was on television from 1952 to 1956.
Mm.
It starred Eve Arden.
One of the great...
The great Eve Arden.
Comedic actresses ever.
As a...
School teacher.
Sarcastic high school teacher.
Yes. This, I think, also was a show that started in radio.
It did start in radio. TV. Yeah. And it was one of the big hits of the 50s.
Yeah.
And rightly so. I had never seen a single episode of Our Miss Brooks. And, oh God, how funny this show was.
I had seen a few when I was a kid, but I didn't remember. I wasn't old enough to get it. But yeah, the episode we watched was hysterically funny.
About returning gifts. And everybody is trying to return gifts. To have money, it's more gift of the magi kind of thing.
Yeah, to buy gifts for other
money
people.
To buy gifts for other people. But it's this revolving door.
And it's all this
woman.
This one
grumpy
woman. At the department store.
Who eventually winds up at the same Christmas party and outs them all as they're running around.
Hiding behind the same Santa beard so they don't recognize her.
It has.
She doesn't recognize them.
All those wonderful farcical elements.
Slamming door kind of stuff.
Yeah. But not in a way, because now, as, you know, sophisticated 21st century viewers, we know these things.
Yeah.
And to watch that form be done so impeccably well, and with dialogue that still today, 60-something years later,
65 years later,
is still funny dialogue.
Yeah. Like, I, the biggest sort of revelation
is it on Get TV? as well.
It's on one of them. I've got it in TiVo now.
We've got it in auto record now in TiVo because I'm gonna back up and watch other episodes.
In watching these old TV episodes the last couple of years, the two big revelations for me, as far as like ones that I could see wanting to go back and watch every year, are this episode of Armis Brooks and the Jack Benny episode that's set entirely in the department store where he keeps exchanging
which
the
wallets.
We've talked about that before. With Mel Blanc as the poor guy behind the counter. God, so funny.
If y'all still are with the cord and the cable TV, go to Get TV and watch Armis Brooks.
Well, I think Get TV is actually terrestrial, so even if you cut the cord but you have like an antenna to get, or whatever, a doohickey to get.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Does any TV have an antenna?
Not an antenna per se, but you know, like there's a device that allows you to get terrestrial stations. You can get TV, you can get Buzzer, you can get Cozy, all that stuff.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Are there other ones, or
that's it?
Okay. Well, I want to talk real quick about just a handful of the Hallmark Channel. I don't know if they were all Hallmark Channel, because maybe they were. Anyway, the ones that stood out for me this year as being really good. The Mistletoe Promise is
okay.
It's talking about popular tropes. It's the fake fiance one. It's the two people where, you know, he's supposed to be a family man to get this work promotion and she got dumped by this guy and wants him to think that she's moved on or whatever. It's Jamie King and I think Luke McFarlane, I want to say.
Right.
Anyway, actually quite charming, and they have really good chemistry, and it's a little better written than a lot of these, and it was pretty good.
All right.
A Heavenly Christmas, which was a Hallmark Hall of Fame movie with Kristen Davis. Apparently, this is like the second movie she's made now where she plays a person who dies and learns the true meaning of Christmas.
Isn't it a little too late after you're dead?
Apparently not. Not if you're Kristen Davis. So she has to be a guardian angel to Eric McCormick, who was a singer with his sister, but then she died, and now he's taking care of her kid, but now his parents want to take her to Florida, and they live in New York, and then Kristen Davis's angel mentor is Shirley MacLaine. It was all right. It had its moments. And then one that kind of caught me by surprise was Broadcasting Christmas.
All right.
Because here's the thing. If you watch a bunch of these movies, you get to know that the ongoing deal is the woman who has chosen career learns that family...
She was wrong.
Exactly. That she should be making cookies and raising children and not running around New York being, you know, a ball buster.
Like, why must the world gender cookies?
I don't know.
Why is making cookies...
a lady thing.
A lady task. I love making cookies because I love eating cookies.
I made cookies over
Everyone
Christmas.
Should make cookies for themselves really and for them. Each other all yes. the time. We were just given a cookie cookbook.
Yes.
For Christmas, Dory's Cookies.
And we're going to make them.
My New Year's resolution, and I have only one.
Make more cookies?
Is to battle fascism with baking cookies.
This Silpat kills fascists.
That's correct. Thank you for that. That's my motto of 2017.
Excellent. Anyway, so here's a movie where the career woman is actually rewarded for her steadfastness as a career woman and gets to remain a career woman at the end of the movie. Melissa Joan...
Does she make cookies for herself?
I don't think any cookies are made in this one. Melissa Joan Hart and Dean Cain play exes who are both competing to be the new morning show co-host of Jack Hay.
Okay.
On a show that looks very sort of, you know, Kathy Lee and Hoda.
Right.
And you know, you keep thinking, because it's one of these Hallmark Channel movies, that at some point, like, Melissa Joan Hart is going to realize that, you know, like, she's been wasting her life on a career when she could have been making cookies for Dean Cain.
Right.
But no, like, she gets to be the career person and still love Christmas and all that stuff. So I was just kind of stunned by that. I also liked Christmas Land, which is the way where Nikki DeLoach inherits her grandmother Maureen McCormick's Christmas tree farm.
Okay.
Because there's snow on the ground.
Look, I'm just glad Maureen McCormick has work.
Yes. That one was nice. And I'm sure I saw a bunch of other ones, but they all kind of blur together after all.
Imagine that.
The cool thing about these Hallmark Channel movies is you can come in the middle of one.
It's a haze.
And you know exactly.
It's an endless haze.
You know where it's been. You know where it's going. Oh, there was one called I'll Be Home for Christmas with mm-hmm. James Brolin and Mina Savari.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. James Brolin directed it. And when you get James Brolin to direct your Christmas movie, you get to have Barbara Streisand Christmas songs in your movie.
That makes sense.
There were like three different Barbara Christmas songs. Like well played.
Classic ones from back in the day?
Yeah, she did.
Like Jingle Bells?
That was in there.
Okay, good, because that's the best one. Yeah,
I forget what the other one was, but I was like, all right, that's a package deal. You know, because otherwise the Hallmark Channel is not affording the Streisand songbook.
I have a feeling that he is the Barbara Whisperer.
Oh, well, yeah, of course.
I guess it's not even a feeling. I mean, she more or less kind of says it.
Yeah.
It's kind of veiled language, but, you know, every once in a while when you get her to, when she talks about him in interviews, mm-hmm. she'll say things like, oh, he has me doing all these things.
Right.
You know, he took me to Target.
Right.
And she's like, I've never been to a Target.
I mean,
Home Depot. Like he gets her to go to weird places for hardware with her, you know.
That totally makes sense. I mean, yeah. What else would their dynamic be like?
I don't know. Her dominating him and keeping him in a box.
But I think she would get bored with that.
She would, I guess. Yeah, yeah.
They keep each other on their toes, those two. The Brolin Streisands of Malibu.
Here are some emails from people.
Yes.
This is from Phil. Phil says, I'm into the Gilmore Girls as much as you two. I started from the pilot premiere when it first aired. Mm. This inside peek is a dream. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
If you are a subscriber to LKTV, you can hear our two Gilmore Girls episodes, one that we did before Gilmore Girls A Year in the Life premiered on Netflix, and then a very dishy, spoilery post episode, both
yes.
featuring Rose Abdu, one featuring Sam Pancake in person, the other one a brief cameo on the phone.
From someone who said he was Sam Pancake.
Yes, as far as
but
we know.
I couldn't tell because it sounded like he had just woken up. It might have been.
But yeah, so if you want the entire backlog of all of our subscriber-only LKTV episodes, go join at patreon.com/linoleumknife.
This is from Clint. I never watched an episode of Gilmore Girls and skipped the last episode about the show. I listened today and I recognized the voice of Rose Abdu from Strangers with Candy when she played the teacher in Spanish driver's ed class.
She gets around that,
so,
Rose.
Yeah, that Rose Abdu, she was on Strangers with Candy mm-hmm. as well. This is another one from Clint. Mm. Same Clint. I am not sure if I'm the right person to ask, considering that I am on the inside looking out. Trevor Noah.
Oh, this was he had written us before about the Trevor Noah Tommy Lauren.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Episode of The Daily Show, and it basically made the case that if he had contradicted her more or like, you know, challenged her more, then he would have fallen into the angry black man stereotype.
Yes, that's what he says. In my opinion.
And I asked him on the show, well, would that apply to him as a South African the way that it would to someone who was born in America? And this is his response.
He said it probably wouldn't matter, mm-hmm. being South African. He said, in my opinion, the people who would label Trevor Noah as angry would probably be the same people who deemed a fist bump between the president and Michelle Obama as a terrorist fist jab, that's in quotes, and that would be the people who support Tommy Lahren. I do agree with you both that it was a mistake having Lahren on the show because at the time she was just contained to Facebook. Now she has a national platform.
That was my point.
To spew her misinformed opinions, which will probably land her a show on Fox News. Now on to more important topics of discussion, Mariah's World. I saw the first episode and I wasn't into it at all. After the second episode, I am fully on board. I think that James and Mariah were never really a couple. They have no chemistry. James greeted her before a show in the second episode and put his arm around her, and she tensed up and recoiled. Mariah and her dancer Tanaka have so much chemistry and have probably been dating the whole time she's been engaged. We're going to catch up on Mariah's world in the next episode of LKTV, where we get back to the business at hand, with the exception of Wendy Williams, who's on vacation right now. Tom Kaiser says, as someone who has never seen a full episode of The Gilmore Girls, but has watched Louis Malle's Atlantic City at least half a dozen times, I thank you for the fan service. Please tell me Dave was fired by the guy whose head exploded in Scanners, as Susan Sarandon was in the film. No, I was not. He was very much a Scanners head exploding kind of manager.
At the hot dog place, right?
No, at McDonald's.
Okay.
Yeah. But I quit. After three shifts, I thought, no. This is not, this can't continue. I must find employment at a minimum wage elsewhere.
Right.
So I went to Baskin-Robbins.
Nice.
And stayed there for the next 3 years, scooping ice cream. Oh, what a wonderful job that was. I never got a raise, but I got a free scoop of ice cream every single shift. That, my friends, is better than money.
How to keep your employees happy.
That's right. That's it. That's all the, that's all of them.
All right. Well, thank you, subscribers, for, this amazing year. We kicked off this program at the end of January, 2016, and, we had no idea that it was going to take.
Well, we kicked off this subscription service at the beginning of February.
Okay, fine.
Our subscriber fiscal year ends at the end of January.
Very well.
Yeah.
In any event, you have made this first year way beyond anything we would have ever expected, and we thank you all.
It's been crazy.
We've had a lot to learn over the course of it about how to make all this work.
How to make everything work.
But y'all have been great, and we're so thankful and so grateful that you have been so supportive of the show and being there with us from the get-go. So that means a lot to us. We thank you for it. And if you have not yet become a subscriber and you want to hear...
If you're listening to this for free.
If you want to hear more LKTV shenanigans, then by all means, go to patreon.com/linoleumknife and look into subscription.
$4 a month.
It starts out as super cheap.
$4 per month gets you LKTV every week, $1 per episode, which is worth, I think.
Indeed.
Kinda. And more dollars per month gets you more things. You can read all that on the site.
And if you subscribe, you can go back and listen to all of our episodes.
All
with,
of them.
With our special guests like Rose Abdu and Sam Pancake. Like Jim Colucci and Frank DiCaro.
Like Brian Fuller.
Talking about American Gods.
People we barely lifted a finger to get to come on the show because we already knew them.
That's right. So if more of you subscribe, maybe we'll actually like find some strangers who are cool and get them on the
Probably
show.
No strangers, because I don't like having strangers in my house.
Fair enough.
Or on my podcast.
That too.
We're just going to have to befriend more people in the television industry.
Yes, but pay us more and we'll make that happen.
Who do we know? Who can we get that we already know?
There are other folks.
Do we have other people?
Yeah, we'll talk about that off mic. But yes, there are other people that we know.
I know you're Twitter friends with some folks.
Well, yeah, but I mean, there's other... Well, we'll figure it out. We'll talk about it off mic. Anyway, y'all are great for listening. We hope you...
We're great for podcasting.
We hope you're having a good holiday. We wish everybody a terrific 2017. And we're going to be back with more stuff. Definitely another Linoleum Knife, a podcast of the cinema this weekend. But there's going to be some extra episodes of things just as we, clear the decks for the year. So check back with us. And until next time, goodbye.